Greetings. This is Eric Andelin, Senior Workflow Specialist with SimActive, and you're listening to Episode 10 of our Pixels and Points podcast, Combining LiDAR and Imaging Data for Drone Mapping. And with me today, I have my guest, Jeff Fagerman, CEO of LiDAR USA. Jeff, say hi to everyone.
Hello. Good to meet you all.
So Jeff and I have a long-term background in photogrammetry and mapping, and we've crossed each other's paths many times. SimActive and LiDAR USA have a great relationship. We work together quite a bit. And as I said, one of the trends these days is integrating sensors and having a dual or more than dual sensor system with LiDAR and imaging sensors. Jeff, talk a little bit about what your company does. I know you guys are not a hardware specific company. You integrate pretty much anything. So, you know, give us a little bit of information on the company, when you started, where you came from, and what you guys are doing now.
Okay, so I've been very fortunate in the sense that I actually went to school for land surveying and photogrammetry geodesy, and that's obviously what we're doing here. So I had that privilege and then worked at Integraph doing exactly what we went to school for 14 years before starting Fagerman Technologies, LiDAR USA, where I actually bought the system that I built for Integraph to do aerial triangulation work, photogrammetry. So I had the theoretical side from school, the software development and hardware development at Integraph, and then the production actually in my own company using the product I made. And that led us then to where we're at now, where we're building, we're better known as LiDAR USA, where we're building LiDAR systems with imaging systems, and you know all the INSs and everything goes along with it. And we're really hardware agnostic. We definitely tend to favor certain hardware over other hardware, but we've integrated at least three dozen different scanner systems. Okay, all the models from each vendor that we work with. We don't always sell all of them, but we've integrated three dozen. In the end, we might integrate five, prove them out, and then we go through a series of tests, you know, looking at penetration, accuracy, intensity, just overall performance and everything. And we say, okay, out of those five, we'll sell this one, or maybe we won't sell any of them. Mm-hmm. So we do that, you know, with LiDAR sensors, with the IMUs, GNSS receivers and even base stations, and then with the cameras as well. And not so much with like the software that comes after our workflow. You know, we finish and then we generate a really nice colorized point cloud. And then, if, you know, the next step would be to integrate like with Correlator 3D or, you know, Autodesk or Bentley or whatever to continue the engineering side. Or whatever it is where the product's going, our customers are varied and they're all over the place. I mean, you may be doing construction, maybe building duck ponds for hunting, believe it or not, highways, roadways, county mapping. We're trying to build the systems that provide that. And it doesn't matter if it's from a car, from a boat, from rail, a backpack, or aerial. We just don't do the high altitude stuff, which is what I was used to be. The thing I only did was the high altitude stuff.
Where we all started.
It was, it was really a big change coming into this market because the cameras we used to use, you know, were the Leica flash hexagon DMC, you know, which cost $1 million, or the UltraCam from Vexel. And then, you know, it was a real step down to come to the UAV market, which obviously is a big part of our business now. And we're using cameras that cost $500, you know, or, oh, it's an expensive one. It costs, you know, $5,000. That's an expensive camera. I mean, we couldn't even get the lens covered for $5,000. So it was a big change. And, you know, everything before was calibrated, you know, sent off to USGS to have the calibration done. Or you use a really expensive piece of software that was built just to do the aerial triangulation and give you a good calibration out of it. And here we are today where a lot of those same features are built right into like Correlator 3D that does the, you know, calibration each time you take the sensor out, which is probably a better way to go too. But that's kind of how we started and where we've come to, and it's how we hooked up with Sim Active, because we needed a good photogrammetry package, and the ones that I was familiar with before kind of faded away and gave way for other packages. And I needed a system, and our customers needed a system that could do, you know, one camera or two cameras or three cameras, you know, small format or large format, and was relatively easy to use and had all the functionality. You know, oftentimes it has way more functionality than the customers know about,
right,
or can use readily, but it's there. It's one of those corner cases. You've got the corner cases, and almost every job has corner cases. Let's face it, that's just the way it is. There's always some little thing in there that you get most of the way there. It's like going through a maze and you just can't get there. Well, you have the tools. Correlator 3D has those tools, and that's why we've chosen to team, you know, and pro-offer to our clients the Sim Active software, because you got the software with all the right features and you have a great support team.
Yeah.
Well, so those are really important.
And one of the things I wanted to mention is, you know, again, because you're working with LiDAR again, we didn't support LiDAR at Sim Active 5 years ago. We are a raster-based product. We are not a point-based product. So that makes things a little bit different. But, you know, again, with the demand for, or with the integration of LiDAR into drones, which, you know, kind of blew up the scene from the LiDAR standpoint, we've had to grow and incorporate that as well. So we've got that to some degree to work with LiDAR data. And it's to our benefit as a software manufacturer, software developer, because we are already working with imaging data. Now we're working with LiDAR data. The two both combined are a fantastic product. And to me, you know, again, we both talk about our prior careers in the large format world. And in the large format world, you can do dual sensor systems, but they don't necessarily make a lot of sense because, for example, LiDAR is best flown at night. Photos don't look so good at night. So, you know, you end up flying two missions anyway. So what's the point of having two holes in the aircraft? But when we talk about drones, now we're talking about much more compact systems, much higher density point clouds, dense enough to almost equate to a photo, and the ability to capture photos at the same time with a similar footprint, because you're only at 400 feet as opposed to being at 20,000 feet. So, talk a little bit about that and, you know, how we've benefited from coming down to, say, a lower altitude.
Yeah. So, yes, definitely the point density is just dramatically different from high altitude. Now, the imagery, you know, the high altitude imagery is still very good.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, because like you're paying for that camera. You're paying $1 million for that camera. And even still, the aerial LiDAR sensors, they are definitely increasing their point density, but they still can't match what we get with a UAV. And in particular, because most people probably fly at like 200 feet. They don't even fly at 400 feet. Mm-hmm. They might fly at 200 feet. And so they're getting the sides of the buildings, the sides of everything. Like the aerial stuff, like on a utility pole, you're going to be getting the top of the pole. Hardly ever will you get like the full shape of the pole. We got much better perspective flying lower, so we get the entire pole. Now, when you talk about adding in the cameras, most of the time, it depends on the LiDAR sensor you have. So some LiDAR sensors have like a field of view of like 45 degrees.
Yeah.
So it's not very big cone that you're measuring, right? So almost any camera will overlap that, you know, with the right focal length lens and everything. But then you got other cameras, I mean, other scanners that, you know, they're spinning 360 and they have, you know, 1500 foot range. So you can have look angles way off to the side beyond use, really.
Yeah.
We say that, but there's always like, hey, I didn't know that building was way out there. So it's kind of nice to have that. Hey, I can see that building 1500 feet off to the side, or that canyon that I didn't know that was there or something. But then you need cameras that can match that field of view if you want to colorize it. So you got many trade-offs. You got scanners that are 360, some that are only 90, some are 70, some are 45 degree field of view. So it depends on what you're doing. You definitely don't want to use a LiDAR sensor that's got a 70 degree field of view if you're mapping, you know, let's say a 1,000-acre block. Now, if you're mapping a long corridor and you can fly high enough to get it wide enough, if you get it all in one or two passes, that's a different story, then that might work. Then flying the imagery and the LiDAR at the same time is a really good deal. So it's still kind of the same thing as the aerial. You know, it's not always the best mix and match. It depends on your camera systems. We have probably our biggest sale is with the cameras is we use a dual 24 megapixel camera setup. Mm-hmm. So the two cameras both fire at the same time, and it gives us an effective pixel width of 11,400 to 11,800 pixels wide, somewhere in there, you know, 4,000 pixels deep. So it's essentially 45 to 50 megapixel camera using two relatively cheap 24 megapixel cameras. And so we're getting a 95 to 100 degree field of view, which is pretty much where you crop most of your LiDAR data anyhow, because once you get, you know, too far off into the look angle, your accuracy is going to fall apart. It doesn't matter how big you use and everything. So that's kind of where we're at, but we support, you know, the Sony cameras, whatever lens on you want. Mm-hmm. It's just that when you do your flight planning, you got to know what is your restriction. The LiDAR, not all LiDARs can fly at 400 feet. Some of them only have, you know, a range of like 200 feet.
Yeah.
So therefore you're limited by height. And then you got to look at your camera you're using. You got a focal a field of view of a certain width, but if you're going to run to make orthos, you need to have, let's say, 70% overlap and side lap. So you got to really restrict then how you define your flight lines. You got to keep all these things together and just, you know, make sense out of it.
Well, I would imagine that's probably one of the biggest challenges for you guys on, you know, when a customer comes to you and says, hey, I want to buy a system. I imagine you spend a lot of time talking about what they're going to use that system for.
Correct. Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, everybody thinks I want to have a camera, but if they're an engineering firm and delivering surfaces, and they're out there right now just collecting it with the GPS equipment, mm-hmm. little stations, they're not delivering any color.
Yeah.
And they kind of get excited. They're like, you know, it's like we can give them a nice demo, show them everything in color, but if they don't deliver it in color, then you don't even need the camera anyhow. But at the flip side of it is they're not delivering color because they can't deliver color with what they're doing now. So now they can see the added benefit of, hey, let's add the camera and we can deliver that ortho.
Yeah.
Or even the colorized point cloud. So that ortho, everybody wants that ortho. I mean, there's a reason Google Earth is so doggone popular because, I mean, it's everybody likes to see it. It's way easier to interpret from a picture than it is from LiDAR as well.
Yep.
I mean, we can do topographic extraction, you know, building outlines and stuff like that from the LiDAR, but let's face it, it's way easier to do that from an ortho.
Right. So for them, for those companies, that's a value add. So if, you know, adding a camera, you're already buying a LiDAR sensor, adding a camera is really not the expensive part of the solution, but your right. ability to turn around and become a differentiator between, you know, company X who's competing with you, providing you just, you know, that point cloud or a surface from that point cloud. Now you've got the ability to provide, as you said, ortho mosaic, which the reality is we all know what's in an image. A lot of people don't know what's in a point cloud when they look at it. So, you know, that's a huge add. And then also on top of that, you can also colorize now that point cloud. So now you've got another value add beyond just classification of, you know, the point cloud. Now you've got color as well to talk about. So I would imagine that, again, those are all the conversations you have with your customers when they come to you to build a system.
Correct.
Yep.
I mean, and the nice thing is, so there's lots of choices, obviously, what to do with the imagery. I mean, lots of different packages. And I guess I would say is, like, why do we highly recommend the SimActive part is because of the tool sets you guys have. Especially when we first started, I don't think any of the other products could actually handle the dual camera configuration that we had. So we got two cameras looking off to the side. And actually, we can have three. I don't know if we ever sold the three, but we have it built so you can have a slightly wider field of view. I mean, imagine now I have, instead of having the two that are giving you essentially a 45, 50 megapixel camera, you have three, one looking later and two looking more off to the side. I mean, that'll run through SimActive just fine.
Yeah.
It's through the SimActive software. That is not a problem. Where that's not true or it wasn't true before. But it's not just that. It also runs through it quickly.
Right.
Which is, you know, a big thing. You don't want to sit there. So our, like our LiDAR, the only thing that really slows us down in getting a point cloud out is getting the geometry right, which would be the PPK solution, getting the trajectory.
Right.
Okay. Where with the imagery, you don't even have to have an INS right or a GPS receiver. Right. You don't have to. Definitely is an advantage, but you don't have to, so you don't have to go through that step. But you know, the PPK step, while it's not intensive, it does take a few minutes. And that's really where more all the knowledge comes from, is to the coordinate systems and just how to solve it, you know, the forward reverse solutions and all that kind of stuff. Well, we can generate a point cloud quickly, and then you want to colorize it, but nobody wants to sit around and wait, you know, till tomorrow to colorize it. I'd kind of like to colorize it today. And you know, even a small project, like I think the one we sent you to look at, it's like 10, 15 acres maybe. That one only had just less than 100 photos in it, but you know, it solves through there really quickly. And you know, we can colorize it. It's, you know, 15, 20 minutes. Depends on the computer that you're using, of course, and the hard drives, but it's not an extremely long wait, which is kind of important.
Yeah, I would agree. I tell people all the time, when it comes to LiDAR, it's all about solving the math up in the air. It's all about solving all that. Once you get that, then you're okay. But you can't lose data. You can't be without something. Whereas with photogrammetry, as long as we know the size of the image, the focal length of the camera, the PPK could completely fail. And as long as we've got control on the ground, we could still come up with a solution. So it is, on our side, admittedly, producing the surface model is what takes the longest time on our end. It's not long comparatively. It's still something that happens relatively fast, but now we're talking about combined systems where, you know, the LiDAR's been processed. You already have a surface from the LiDAR, so you can completely skip that step when you bring it into correlated 3D. And if you choose to use a LiDAR surface rather than an image-based surface, which is perfectly fine, you can skip that DSM creation part, which makes things go by even that much faster. So I like to say it's certainly complementary mapping techniques. And if you have both, you can even speed up the process more by using both. So that's really important. And one of the things I wanted to bring up was I came into LiDAR after the airborne side. So I had kind of moved out of production of mapping from large format aircraft and into the business development side and all of that. So I kind of stayed out of the LiDAR side of it when it was developed. But I remember, you know, 2 points per square meter, 8 points per square meter, things like that. And then when I did get involved in LiDAR was mobile LiDAR. Now we're talking about 300 points per square meter, 600 points per square meter. Density so thick that, I mean, you can pick out every feature, which is fantastic. And that was mobile LiDAR. Now we have the same thing going on in the airborne LiDAR for drones, because you are that close to the ground, you can get that kind of density. One of the things that I always thought was cool, and you know, I'll admit that at one time I worked for a company here in Florida. We bought a system from you guys, and the best thing about it is that it was convertible. So if we weren't flying airborne LiDAR projects, we could convert it right over to the mobile system, and it worked outstanding. So just the versatility of the systems that you're building. I'm just pointing it out, but you can comment on it. As you said, you've had it in aircraft, you've had it on boats, you've had it on, vehicles, as long as the whole unit, correct me if I'm wrong, as long as the whole unit is self-contained, as far as nothing's changed in the geometry from the IMU to the LiDAR sensor to the camera, all of those things are still constant, you could put it anywhere.
Yes, I mean, we've actually done a bunch of projects where you may want to actually be on a boat. So you're on a boat, so you can want to get the bridge that goes over the water body, and but then shoreline, because you can see some things from the boat that because you're down there on the water, 6 feet above the water, that you can't necessarily see as well from the drone, but we'll scan from the boat, then we'll scan. I've actually done it with scan from the boat, then there's a railroad track along the way, scan from the rail, and then scan from the UAV, and then you want the neighborhood too, so you're going to scan from the car. So literally all those. Only thing we didn't do was a backpack, because I didn't need to.
Yep.
But you can do those all with the same unit in the same day. And that's nice. And like on the UAV side, you can add in a 360 camera, like the Ladybug or some of the other cameras for the immersive 3D imagery, like you see in Google Street View.
Right.
So yeah, we have one system that can do it all, that put a camera in the air, put the camera on the car, same LiDAR in both places, different orientations. And yeah, the key is keeping the INS locked rigidly to the LiDAR sensor and to the cameras.
Right.
But like you said, with the cameras, it's not as critical. It's got to be locked, but you have a lot more freedom with the cameras, because if you lose data, you're not done.
Yeah.
Because everything is like a plank of plywood, right? You can still sew them together.
Yeah.
That's the nice thing. Whereas the LiDAR, it's a gigantic slinky. Anything goes wrong with the slinky, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
And that's one of the nice things too, is like using the imagery. If you did an area that was feature rich, not over a forest, you can solve the photogrammetry, and then you could use the photogrammetry to generate control points, which then controls the LiDAR.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you could do the opposite. I mean, in the old days, I remember when the LiDAR first really started coming out in prevalence and countywide mapping, they generate the LiDAR and pick the control points out of the LiDAR to control the photogrammetry, so they lined up really well. Because it was a big time savings in picking control points, because the surveyor, if you've ever had to go out on like a county or something more than 1,000-acre job to collect control points, you're going to have to cross things that you can see. You need to put that control point a quarter of a mile. It's just that it happens to be an 8-mile drive to get there.
Yeah.
Because you got to go all the way around to get over to that spot you can't get to, and yet you can see it, but you can't get there.
Well,
So being able to use a control from one to control the other, or vice versa, that's a major advantage. And as long as it's a consistent product in the end and actually accurate, that's all that matters.
Well, and you're correct. You sent me over a data set, and I'll get into that, because we will do a demo portion of this as well. And as I wanted to mention, we do see questions that come in. Obviously, we're here having this conversation and we're getting into a demo, so we're a little bit busy here. We'll get to your questions as soon as possible. And the other thing I wanted, I always forget to do this. I just wanted to go back again, and as we're chatting, these are the things we're covering. The value of integrated LiDAR and imaging sensors, which we've kind of talked about already. Optimizing workflows with dual sensor systems. Again, we've chatted about that a bit. Using Correlator 3D to confirm data accuracy. We will go over that. And then creating high quality point clouds and mosaics. And again, I'll go over that in the demo portion. But so we've covered the value of integrating LiDAR and imaging sensors. Obviously, we can speed up our processing times. We can increase the amount of coverage that we get. Whether that's, underneath vegetation. And then you just brought something up that I wanted to bring to point, which is using Correlator 3D to confirm data accuracy. And in that, you mentioned using the LiDAR to pick, or imagery to pick control points for the LiDAR in large projects. And also the opposite of that is true. because we have such dense point clouds from low altitude LIDAR, you can convert that to an intensity image. You can import that intensity image into Correlator 3D, and you can pick control points from that, which then you can use to control the imagery. So you're actually picking the elevation value from the imported LIDAR surface. You're picking the horizontal value from the intensity image. And that is a helpful way to move along, because typically on a LIDAR project, control points are spread out a little bit more. Not because you don't necessarily, your solution comes from, as you said, that slinky in the sky. Aerial mapping needs a little bit more to help in the AT process. So if you've got a good LIDAR surface, you can pick control points like crazy in there and add those to the aerial solution, and you'll get a better solution. That's a benefit of having a dual sensor system for sure. And in a specific example, again, when I was working here for a company in Florida, we had used this system to collect mobile data, and we collected a stretch of highway to do the mobile data, and we got such dense features out of that image-based point cloud, we could actually collect planimetrics from it, but we also didn't have coverage to the outside of the corridor because, you know, LIDAR didn't penetrate that far or was going up. So we flew both sides of the corridor with the drone as well and used that LIDAR data to control the data for the drone. So that's a good example. Again, technically you're not supposed to be flying your drone over the road, so just fly parallel on both sides. You can capture extra data and get enough overlap and enough side lap to do stereo and all of that, so you still got a quality data set. But that's one of the things, as far as, you know, again, it covers a little bit of optimizing, and it covers a little bit of the data accuracy part. Because in reality, if you've got PPK or RTK with your drone and you're not necessarily collecting LIDAR, but you can create a good solution, you can compare that to a LIDAR surface. And in Correlator 3D, I'll show you the difference of what a surface created from SimActive is versus the surface that's created from the LIDAR, and you can do a comparison of the two. And if the change is not much, then you've confirmed that you've got a good data set. And this is not to say that you have to, in that case, collect LIDAR at the same time. This could be, you know, for instance, here in Florida, we have a excellent LIDAR data set statewide that Dewberry collected, you know, a year ago. I think it's accurate to 10 centimeters for the state. That's pretty good. So, you know, you can use maybe not even a LIDAR data set that was collected at the same time. It could have been collected from a mobile system. It could have been collected from an airborne system. It could have been collected from a drone. As long as you know what the accuracy of that data set is, you can use it to quantify or clarify the accuracy of an image-based data set. So that's another thing that I think is kind of important. So projects that you guys get involved in, I know you guys do or assist your customers in doing big projects. Are there any nuances, any unique things that you guys end up dealing with that, you know, you're building your systems to support those projects?
Yeah, I mean, every time you do one, there's gonna be something unique about it. The one thing I came to my mind was the dual purpose of the system being able to be on a UAV versus on a car. A lot of times, if people make a system that's just for UAV and the guy wants to do, comes to us to do roadway work, they're going to try to fly lower, you know, to improve the accuracy, which that's great, but, you know, nobody wants to fly lower. If you're the pilot, you never want to fly lower. No. It brings a certain pucker factor to life.
Oh, yeah.
It's called crash is imminent. There are vertical obstructions, and some of them are moving vertical obstructions called birds. But you know, things that cause problems. But the nice thing is like you said, like the right of way and the stuff that's like 500-600 feet off of your line of travel of a vehicle, get that with a UAV, but then turn around and capture the roadway, you know, at the best accuracy you can get. Mm-hmm. Right. So put the targets down on a road and drive the road. right, both directions and get the highest level of accuracy you can get from your system, as many control points as you need. And if, you know, using control points, that's what pulls the aerial UAV work and the mobile data together as one set. I mean, I know they call it, make it sound like a mystery and everything, mm-hmm. the data fusion, whatever, but the control points are the key. They're the magic. As long as they're right, everything's tied to that. Everything's homogenous. It's just a different level of accuracy. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the surveyor, the car data versus the UAV data. UAV data is kind of like the surveyor talking to a GIS guy not so many years ago. You know, they're out there collecting manholes with an L1 receiver.
Yeah.
You know, we know the manholes in this intersection. Just don't ask me where, you know. And well, the surveyor's got, you know, his multi-constellation, multi-frequency equipment. Because it costs a lot more, you know, and it's a lot bigger. You wouldn't want to build a cadastre, you know, with 1 meter data and
right.
5 centimeter data. But at the same time, you know, you need to mix and match them. They both have their place. And it's the same thing with the mobile data and UAV data. Although I will say the UAV data can be just about as good in some cases.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty doggone amazing. It all depends on the instrumentation, the software, and the user. I mean, the user is a very, very, very big part of the equation. You know, it's just like a golf club. $5,000 golf club doesn't make you a golfer.
Right.
Makes you the owner of a $5,000 golf club.
yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to it. But, yeah, every project poses something new, some new twist. Like the targets is a good one. I thought I'd seen all kinds of targets from doing conventional aerial. We did the Navajo Nations project once, and you know that thing is huge.
Yeah,
it's bigger than most states. And I had about every conceivable type of aerial target you can imagine. And where is the point in the target? Is it the center of the T? Is it the inside vertex of the chevron? The tip of the chevron?
Yep.
You know, is it's across whatever? Now I see people using like 5 gallon buckets for your control point, mm-hmm. you know, and the points on the top of the bucket, or they'll build little pyramids.
Yeah.
And then I've also seen them where they just drive a 2x2 inch surveyor stake and, you know, 3 foot tall grass, you know, and expect that to be the control point for the UAV project.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of project that one's for. That wood stake sticking out of the ground, some unknown height, is going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Unlikely you're going to see it in any data set.
You're absolutely right. We run across this a lot, you know, from our end, because we get to see a lot of data sets. And I can't tell you how many times targets have been placed in such a way that they're under a tree, that they're too small to identify, that they're in a place that's been destroyed. There's just a lot of factors that, like you said, come down to the crew and the operator and their knowledge of what they're doing and how much care and effort they put into setting a project up. Because like you said, it's, you know, you can have an expensive drone, but that's all you have is an expensive drone, unless you've got good operators to actually, you know, create a scenario where you're going to succeed with your mapping data. So you know, the other thing I wanted to ask was, I know you guys do, or you guys are involved in a lot of projects that are TV type stuff. And, you know, I mean, I know the users are going to ask this, who gets to go travel there? Is it you? Is it Nathan? Is it someone else? You know, and is it worth traveling all the way there? Because you probably got to deal with malaria and, you know, all kinds of other crazy things, plus flying a drone in a country that may or may not even want one there.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about talking about that, but that's a good point. Oh, yes, it's the first time you go to do one of these things, and they talk about, well, can we do it in one pass? And you're like, why do we have to do it one pass? Because you might get shot down on the second pass.
Yeah.
I think we'll take a different project, okay? The live volcano that we wanted to scan isn't as dangerous as the habitants at the base of the volcano.
Sure.
Let's say. And they're like, it's trying to assure you that it's safe. And the same day they're telling you this, on the internet comes up this picture of the guy with the vest of bullets, and they just killed a tribe, you know. I was like, yeah, we're not going there. But and then the other thing too is to go to the places, yeah, to have to go to an infectious disease center, which they're not like in every city.
Yeah,
you gotta go to an infectious disease center to get vaccinations, so you don't, you know, pick up something you don't want to get.
Yep.
Which is very possible in a lot of these places. A lot of things we take for granted. Yes. And then, so who goes on the trips? Well, the first time we did a TV show, I went to the first one. It was very interesting. I never look at TV the same after you do a TV show.
Yep.
I never look at anything. So I've tried to rotate different people through the different TV shows. We've done Expedition Unknown with Josh Gates at least 3 times, maybe 4 times. And this last one was this last summer. It's very interesting. He starts with an excerpt. This time I sent 2 son-in-laws and my daughters.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they all know how to do everything.
Yep.
And he starts off with, oh, yeah, I don't know you guys. And he shows a picture of me for a moment. And then he shows a picture of my son, Daniel, who was also, he was in the jungles with him in Ecuador. Very interesting one.
Wow.
And what was the highlight of that one? Daniel throwing up in the helicopter. And of course he shows that, but it's very interesting. We try to send somebody. Just about everybody in offices have been on some show or another. We've been on about 2 dozen different shows. Very interesting. Some of them are very little. We did one this last year. I can't remember who it was, National Geographic, but none of the team actually made it on there, just the instrumentation. And it's very interesting. It was in a location where bald eagles are as common as seagulls.
Wow.
Along the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know, we're always like, wow, there's a bald eagle. They're like, shoo away, there's so many. But yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, you don't know where LIDAR and the photogrammetry is going to lead you. It's going to lead you in places you never expected.
And that's the point I really wanted to bring up is although we're talking about LIDAR and we're talking about imagery and we're talking about mapping, it can take you to places and to projects that, you know, it may not be about how accurate it is. And I'll tell you, one of the things that it grinds me all the time is when I hear somebody in the drone world talk about how accurate their data is to an infinite degree that it doesn't need to be, even if it was. But again, you guys go to challenging places. You have crews that are adult and know how to handle situations when they go into a country and the drone hasn't shown up, or they've got to go through customs with the drone. They've got to deal with being sick, getting malaria shots, all of those things. And out of that may come a few minutes of imagery or video of collecting LIDAR. But maybe the deliverable is, even out of that show, is showing something to people that they haven't seen before because of the sensors that you're using to collect that kind of data. And I think that's fascinating. And it only does to serve our profession, you know, very well.
Yep. Yeah. So that actually, I'll say this, but along that same line, I'm trying to bolster our society. I like what Elaine Ball, for instance, is doing with kids into surveying.
Yeah.
You guys have probably been involved with that. We have recently actually donated to where I went to school, which is Ferris State University in Big Rapids, Michigan. We actually just donated a UAV LIDAR system.
Yes. Yep.
It's our Surveyor 32. Man, that was an interesting experience. I never knew it would be hard to give something away.
Yep.
But it was. But I did it because I'm like, you know, I like to get kids into surveying thing. You know, you draw people into our environment because I think it's a admirable profession that we do, whether it's photogrammetry or surveying or civil engineering or the LIDAR processing. It's a good thing. We're actually doing something that's good for society. I mean, that's the whole thing about licensing with a surveyor is, you know, you get the license is there to protect the public.
Right.
Right. From fraudulent work, okay, which I think that's one of the things kind of missing in the whole UAV market. You know, it's tippy-turvy. I don't want to go into that, but, you know, it's where the lines of photogrammetry, GIS, all the UAV stuff crosses the line into surveying. you know, we want to have something there that does protect the public.
Yeah.
Because the public doesn't know what we do. You can't expect them. I don't know what the doctor does either, or what the lawyer does, or the dentist, or whatever. But I expect them to be, you know, professional and do their job, and not with negligence. And so that's why I donated the system to Ferris, so that they can draw more students. Because
mm-hmm.
it's hard to get people into surveying, especially if they have the alternative is civil engineering.
Right.
Because they know they can understand that more. They don't understand surveying as much. And most people coming into surveying are coming from having had experience from military, or they grew up with their relative who was a surveyor.
Yep.
Okay. But if you can go to high school and show you can fly a drone and generate a point cloud and have this wow factor, that gives you a chance to get more students into your program.
Yep.
Well, that's what I figured. And into a lucrative business.
Yep.
And it's a good business.
And I'll add to that that on the photogrammetry side, we have ASPRS certifications. So, yes, it's not a professional license such as a surveyor, but I'd sure like to know that the person working with that surveyor, or the person that's working in a state that doesn't require that survey, at least has some knowledge of photogrammetry. And I think you can get that still. I know you can still get that through the ASPRS. They even actually have a UAS certification. So for what it's worth, it's there. From here, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to let Jeff go, and we're going to go into, because I know he's a busy man, he's got to go to another country and shoot some pyramids or something. I'm going to go ahead and get into the demo portion of this and discuss, you know, how the integration of these sensors can be beneficial and how we would do that in Correlator 3D. So once again, I'd like to thank my guest, Jeff Fagerman, CEO of LiDAR USA. Thank you. Any last comments?
No, thank you. Hope everybody enjoys it and learns something.
This podcast was created in conjunction with a webinar. You can access that webinar as well as previous webinars and podcasts by going to our website, simactive.com, where they can be found under the Learning tab. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share on social media. You can also subscribe to this podcast through many of the popular podcast subscription sites. Once again, thanks for joining us. Until next time.